The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
On the show today, Faith Perlow tells about a major railroad development in India. Then, Brian Lynn presents our science report. And we'll close the show with our American history program, The Making of a Nation. Now, here is Faith Perlow.
Indian Railways is getting closer to finishing work on a new rail line, connecting Indian-controlled Kashmir to the rest of India. Officials say the line could bring big changes to the area. They say it will permit faster movement of people, goods, and security workers. Indian-controlled Kashmir shares a border with India's two main competitors, Pakistan and China. Darshana Jardos is India's Minister of State for Railways. During a recent visit to check on progress on the line, she said the railway network is important for security. Officials say the 272-kilometer Udhampur, Srinagar, Baramula Rail Link, USBRL project involves highly advanced engineering knowledge. The line runs through a mountainous area. Irfan Mushtaq, a contractor for Konkan Railways, is building a railway station at Raisi near the southern end of the line. He told VOA that it had been one of the most challenging projects he has ever worked on because of the terrain, lack of skilled laborers, and bad weather. "We have worked day and night for this project to complete. This project will benefit the locals of Raisi and the people of the region as a whole," he said. The USBRL was declared a national project in 2002. Officials say the line will contain the world's highest rail bridge, 38 tunnels, and 931 bridges. The Chenab Bridge crosses the Chenab River at a height of 359 meters. The tunnels will have a combined length of 119 kilometers. The system will include the two longest transportation tunnels in India, at 12.75 and 11.2 kilometers. The project also includes the Anjikhad Bridge, Indian Railways' first cable-supported rail bridge. The 750-meter bridge will cross high above the Anjikhad River. The part supported by cables will be 473 meters long. India created a rail connection to Jammu after gaining independence from British rule in 1947. The first passenger train arrived at Jammu station in December 1972, but it has taken another 50 years for Indian Railways to build the rail line through to the Kashmir Valley. Devendra Sharma is a site engineer with the company Afcons Infrastructure Limited. It has been building a bridge at Raisi since 2016. He praised the jobs created by the project and noted that the company hires local workers. "On average, we employed 700 to 800 laborers daily," to complete this bridge, which we expect to complete by the end of May, Sharma said. Officials say the railway line will also increase tourism in the region and give local farmers access to a larger market. However, some Kashmiris are concerned the project could harm the area. It currently is India's only Muslim-majority region. Some local Muslims worry that the rail line could change that. Some also oppose the increased military presence in the area that is expected as a result of the project. I'm Faith Perlow.
A new study suggests water may have existed on Mars much more recently than past evidence has shown. The research is based on data collected by China's Zhurong Explorer vehicle. The Explorer, or rover, arrived on the planet in 2021. Evidence of surface water was found in warmer areas of Mars that might have been fertile enough to support conditions for life, the researchers said. A study reporting the results was recently published in Science Advances. A scientific team from China's Institute of Geology and Geophysics led the research. The institute is part of the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Today, Mars has a cold desert climate, but past studies have provided evidence that ancient Mars had large amounts of water. This is believed to have included rivers, lakes, and oceans. A 2015 study by the American Space Agency, NASA, suggested that 4.3 billion years ago, Mars likely had an ocean covering nearly half of the planet's northern hemisphere. There are different theories for what caused large amounts of water to disappear from Mars. The most likely explanation is that the liquid escaped when the planet's atmosphere thinned over time, NASA explains. This let the water evaporate, turning the Martian surface into a frozen desert. The space agency estimates the evaporation happened about 3 billion years ago. In the new study, researchers said the Chinese rover observed salt-rich sand dunes on the surface. The dunes contained breaks, crusts, and small hills. The team said these landforms provide evidence that land had frozen and then melted in the areas studied. The melting could have happened as recently as a few 100,000 years ago, the study said. The rover's observations were made in an area called Utopia Planitia, a large flat area called a plain in Mars's northern hemisphere. The researchers said they believe the dunes were likely formed sometime after 1.4 million to 400,000 years ago, possibly even more recently. Conditions during that period were likely similar to how things are on Mars today. Xiao Guangqin is with the Institute of Geology and Geophysics and was a co-writer of the study. He told the Associated Press, "We think it could be a small amount, no more than a film of water on the surface." The rover did not directly observe water in the form of frost or ice, but Cheen said computer modeling and observations by other spacecraft on Mars suggest that even today, at some times of the year, conditions could be right for water to appear. Planetary scientist Frederick Schmidt is with the University of Paris, Saclay. He was not part of the study, but he said he finds the results notable because they demonstrate how young the dunes are. This is clearly a new piece of science for the area, Schmidt told the AP. The researchers said they believe small openings filled with salty water were created by melting frost or snow. This likely resulted in the small cracks, hard crusty material, and other surface changes observed by the rover. The team ruled out wind as a cause, as well as frost made of carbon dioxide, which makes up most of the Martian atmosphere. The rover has now provided evidence that there may be a wider distribution of this process on Mars than previously identified, said Mary Bork. She is an expert in Mars geology at Trinity College Dublin in Ireland. She added that although the evidence suggests small amounts of water, it could still be important in identifying environments that could support life. The findings were reported days after China confirmed its Zhurong rover has yet to wake up since going into hibernation for the Martian winter nearly a year ago. Chinese space officials have said the rover's solar equipment is likely covered with dust, blocking the sun and cutting power to the explorer. Before it went silent, Zhurong had explored the Martian surface for 358 days and traveled 1,921 meters, space officials said. This was far longer than the rover's planned 3-month operation, officials added. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn now joins me to talk more about this week's science report. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Of course, Katie. Thanks for having me.
In your report, we learned about new findings on the presence of water on Mars, made by a Chinese exploring vehicle. There have been a number of other studies in recent years looking at the possible existence of water on Mars. What is different about this one?
So the main difference is the researchers said the evidence points to water possibly being on Mars much more recently than previously thought. The time period they're estimating is still in the very distant past, from 1.4 million to about 400,000 years ago, but this is still a lot more recent than past studies have shown. Most have suggested that billions of years ago, Mars contained very large amounts of water, with lakes, rivers, and even a huge ocean. This was because the planet was warmer and held conditions for water to exist. But the planet went through major changes, and today is a frozen desert. Until now, there has not been much evidence of liquid existing more recently.
We also learned in the story the Chinese rover that collected the water data is no longer operating. Is that expected to change?
So Chinese space officials have said they have not been able to establish contact with the vehicle for nearly a year. The Explorer is powered by the sun and is likely covered with dust and cannot power up. And officials say it is unlikely they will be able to reestablish contact.
Well, thanks again for joining me, Brian.
You're welcome. Thank you, Katie.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue our series of time capsule programs, each one exploring another facet, decade, or period of America in the 20th century. Science brings an end to World War II and lays the groundwork for a new attention to research, development, and scientific education in the years to come. World War II ended with an action that was never taken before in the history of warfare and has never been taken since. It required the efforts of a team of scientists. Working in secrecy, they designed and built the first atomic bombs. President Harry S. Truman made the decision to use these weapons against Japan in August of 1945.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
America's use of atomic weapons brought years of conflict in Europe and the Pacific to an end. But it also marked the beginning of the nuclear age. And it represented, in a dramatic way, the growing importance of science and technology in modern times. Interest in science goes back to the earliest days of the nation. President Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were famous not only as political leaders, but also as inventors and scientists. President Abraham Lincoln and Congress established the National Academy of Sciences during the Civil War in the 1860s. And in the early 1900s, the nation created scientific offices to study and improve agriculture, public health, even air travel. By the start of World War I in 1914, the federal government was employing scientists in many areas of work. President Woodrow Wilson created the National Research Council to organize the work of scientists and engineers to win the war. However, before World War II, government support for science was generally limited. The government was willing to pay for research only to meet certain clear goals, such as better weapons or military transport systems. World War II greatly changed the traditionally limited relationship between American scientists and the federal government. In the early years of the war, the German forces of Adolf Hitler showed the world the power of their new tanks, guns, and other weapons. President Franklin Roosevelt knew that the United States would need to develop modern weapons of its own if it entered the war. For this reason, Roosevelt established a National Defense Research Committee in 1940 to support and organize research on weapons. The new committee included some of the top scientists in America. Among its members were the presidents of Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Bell Laboratories. The committee did its work so well that Roosevelt later formed an even more powerful Office of Scientific Research and Development. The leader of both groups was Vannevar Bush, no relation to the future presidents. He had long experience as a professor of electrical engineering and as an inventor. Many scientists knew him. Vannevar Bush put together a hard-working team, and in the years that followed, American scientists and engineers developed one invention after another to help the war effort. Scientists developed new devices to help the Navy find German submarines. They improved methods for bombers to find their targets, and they developed more powerful rockets to protect American troops when they landed on foreign beaches. American scientists and doctors also made great progress in improving the methods of wartime medicine. World War II may well have been the first war in history in which a wounded soldier was more likely to survive than to die. But in many ways, the most important scientific development of the period was the atomic bomb. In 1939, Albert Einstein wrote President Roosevelt a letter. The scientist told the president that it might soon be possible to build a powerful weapon, a weapon that would use the power of the atom. And he urged Roosevelt to get American scientists to build the atomic bomb before German scientists could build one. Roosevelt agreed. He created a special team of scientists. Their work became known as the Manhattan Project. Roosevelt made sure that these scientists got all the money and supplies they needed. Roosevelt died before the scientists could complete their work. But in April 1945, the scientists told the new president, Harry Truman, that they were almost ready to test their invention. Just 3 months later, they exploded the world's first atomic bomb in the desert in the southwestern state of New Mexico. Truman had to make a difficult decision. He knew the atomic bomb would cause widespread death and suffering if it was used on a Japanese city. But he was willing to do anything to avoid the need for American troops to invade Japan. In Japan, a new prime minister and government were searching for a way to end the war. But Truman believed that the Japanese were still not ready to surrender, and he felt it was his duty to end the war as soon as possible. On August 6, 1945, the first atomic bomb fell on the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, a second A-bomb fell on the city of Nagasaki.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us.
President Truman.
It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies.
The Radiation Effects Research Foundation in Japan estimates that between 150,000 and 246,000 people died within 2 to 4 months of the bombings. The bombings left Japan's rulers with no choice. In less than 1 week, they surrendered.
I received this afternoon a message from the Japanese government. I deem this reply a full acceptance of the Potsdam Declaration, which specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. In the reply, there is no qualification. Arrangements are now being made for the formal signing of the surrender terms at the earliest possible moment. General Douglas MacArthur has been appointed the Supreme Allied Commander to receive the Japanese surrender.
In this newsreel, we hear General MacArthur accepting the surrender of the Japanese Empire.
The battleship Missouri, 53,000-ton flagship of Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet, becomes the scene of an unforgettable ceremony marking the complete and formal surrender of Japan. General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, Supreme Allied Commander for the occupation of Japan, boards the Missouri. Fleet Admiral Nimitz, Pacific Fleet Commander, and Admiral Halsey welcome MacArthur and his Chief of Staff, General Sutherland, aboard. It is Sunday, September 2nd, 1945.
We are gathered here, representatives of the major warring powers, to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate. The terms and conditions upon which surrender of the Japanese Imperial forces is here to be given and accepted are contained in the instrument of surrender now before you. I now invite the representatives of the Emperor of Japan and the Japanese government and the Japanese Imperial General Headquarters to sign the instrument of surrender at the places indicated.
American scientists and engineers proved that a war could be won with research as well as bullets. And all Americans learned how much could be gained when government agencies, scientists, and universities worked together for common goals. Roosevelt had understood this long before the war ended. He asked Vannevar Bush to study how the federal government could work with scientists and universities in peacetime. Bush offered a number of ideas to President Truman at the end of the war. He told the president that science was important to America's progress and safety. He called on the federal government to support scientific study and education. Professor Bush said that the nation's universities should be greatly strengthened. He called for the creation of a new government agency to provide money for science projects. Truman and Congress agreed with Vannevar Bush, and in the next few years, American research efforts expanded. In 1946, the Office of Naval Research was created to support basic science study in universities. In the same year, the government created the Atomic Energy Commission. And in 1950, it created the National Science Foundation to provide support to thousands of the nation's best scientists. In the years that followed, American science would grow beyond the wildest dreams of Vannevar Bush and other scientists of his time. Universities would add thousands of new students, along with new laboratories and research centers. By the middle of the 1960s, the federal government would spend more than $13 billion a year for research and development. And 500 new centers of higher learning would be created. All this investment would help make the United States the world leader in such fields as computer science, genetics, and space travel.
That's all the time we have for today's program. but we'll be back tomorrow with another Learning English program on the Voice of America. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Dan Friedel.